The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson.
And I'm your other host, Jody Green.
And today we are joined over the interwebs by a friend of the show, Dr. Rob Morrison of the USDA. Thank you for joining us here today, Rob.
Thank you for having me.
We are very excited to chat with you. I think it's going to be really interesting to hear about some of the stored product research that you do, and also to get a bit of a perspective on working for the government. I know we have a lot of students that listen to the show, and maybe we can pick your brain a little bit about what they can do to maybe prepare themselves for a career such as yours.
Government positions, especially with ARS, are usually full-time research positions. Things you can do to increase your research credentials, all the better. So things like publishing, presenting, showing that you can communicate with stakeholders, organizing symposia, moderating, that sort of thing. It always helps if you think you're interested in, you know, maybe a career with the USDA or government, kind of shadow someone, maybe, you know, get some experience working as an intern in the lab. I have several undergrads that I pay to work in my lab, and so they've gotten lots of great experience and seen kind of how things work in government and that sort of thing. So if you're early in your career, especially, there's lots of opportunities to get involved in government labs.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started and how you ended up where you are?
Sure. So I'm originally from Mesa, Arizona, and I went to college at Kalamazoo College, and I had already known since high school that I wanted to be a biologist of some sort. And so kind of over time, I've whittled away to what kind of biologist I want to be. By the time I got to college, I was thinking more kind of ecologist, but then I did a fun kind of independent research project with my academic advisor at the time, who was the one entomologist at my school. And so that introduced me to the wonderful world of insects and like all the cool questions you can ask and how important they are to our everyday lives. And that kind of just set me on the track to go on with entomology. And so then for my master's, I did that at the University of Munich in Germany. That was more kind of basic research, looking at evolution and speciation between two closely related species of ants. And then after that, I realized, okay, I can't do basic research. There's not enough, you know, impetus. Like, I'm very kind of driven to improve society and so forth. And so I really enjoy research that has some practical implications, immediate practical implications. And so after that, I did my PhD at Michigan State University with a vegetable entomologist there, looking at the integrated pest management and helping to develop a program for an important pest of asparagus called the asparagus miner. And so that kind of got me down the research, you know, applied research sort of track. And then for my postdoc, I worked, actually did that at a USDA lab with Dr. Tracy Leskey, working on the brown marmorated stink bug and helping to develop an attract and kill program to manage their populations in tree fruit.
You've hit on a lot of my favorite things here. I mean, brown marmorated stink bug, asparagus, Germany, all these things are amazing.
You can have it all, right? I think, you know, it's been nice to work in these different systems, because then as I've been applying for jobs, I can really demonstrate that I'm flexible. I can adapt to new systems. Basically, from my PhD onwards, I've asked a lot of IPM sort of questions, like how can we better manage agricultural pests and how can we improve the sustainability of agriculture? And so, you know, in asking these questions, you can ask them in a variety of systems. Just because, you know, you go from vegetables to tree fruit, you know, maybe the specifics are a little bit different, but a lot of the same sort of questions still apply.
I feel like I've also known you quite a bit from ESA. Like, I didn't know who you were, but I saw you in like every symposium I ever went to. I feel like you were very active as a moderator, amongst other things. Am I accurate in that assessment?
I've been kind of all over the place, so it would make sense that you've seen me in that moderation role. Yeah.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about what your interactions with ESA have been, and with NCB, the North Central branch in particular.
Ever since my PhD, so that would be 2010 is when I first became a member of ESA. I love ESA. It's my professional home. I've served on over 15 committees for the society. I was the chair and then the the vice chair and then the chair for the National Early Career Professionals Committee, which works to help increase retention and promote folks that are early career in the society. So those within the first 5 years of having earned their terminal degree. I've also served on several branch level ECP committees, which is a whole kind of push that I tried to help all the branches undertake when I was chair so that we could increase participation by early career folks, specifically at the branch level. And so I've been involved in various capacities like that, served on awards committees. I got roped into being the local arrangements chair for the next North Central Branch meeting. So I'm knee deep at this point, or maybe head deep is the more appropriate term.
You'll never escape.
Yeah. So it's no wonder you seem so familiar, even though I know that we've just met in the last year. But yeah, we have seen you all over the place.
That was absolutely my sentiment. Was like, I know that guy. I see him every year. I didn't know your name. I didn't know what you did. But I just like, he was a reassuring presence at every meeting I was at. I was like, it's a good meeting because that guy's here. Yeah.
So thank you for all that you do. So many good things come out of ESA, like your professional development and then opening up new opportunities.
The early career professional thing in particular, I think, is a really cool concept that's part of the society. I don't know how widespread that is, but I know that I've very much have appreciated it the last 5 years. I am one of the early career people. The discount that you get on admission and just all of the emails and programs that are kind of centered around it, I think it's been an amazing adaptation for the society to make.
And I really like that, you know, ESA leaders have been very supportive of early career professionals. And even in a lot of the, you know, guidelines for when developing symposia for the annual meeting, like they encourage participation by early career folks and students and so forth. And so I think especially at that stage in people's career, it helps so much to have invited talks, like even more so than, you know, necessarily for established people who get invited all over the place all the time. Right. I'm really glad that the leadership in the society has also been very positive towards ECP involvement.
We also were fortunate enough to meet with you when you were at UNL giving a seminar for the yes. Department of Entomology. And you talked about
that was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, because we got to hang out.
I got to pick all your brains about all your horror stories that you get you know, doing your extension stuff.
Well, we had mentioned that some people don't even know we're there. They know we're in Nebraska, but they don't know where to find us. And you asked for us, and we were honored.
I regularly listen to this podcast, so I was so thrilled to get to meet you.
That's weird, but that's cool.
Now he's
and now you're on the podcast. So you talked about stored product pests, and that's your main focus at your USDA lab. Sure. What do you think is the most interesting thing about stored product pests? Because I find them quite interesting myself.
Thinking about that, it's so hard to just pick like one thing, but I can give you a few if that's okay.
That's fine.
One, you know, there's some stored product pests that can actually eat through metal. So their mandibles are strong enough to chew through layers of metal. Which I think is just kind of a crazy thing that an insect can chew through metal, you know?
Which insect is that one?
I forget the specific species, but it's a type of Dromestid that can do that. And okay, another cool thing so is that some can actually grow in reverse. So when food is scarce or conditions are unfavorable, when they molt, they actually molt backwards.
That's awesome.
And that's called retromolting. And so they can... Like you go through this process of like retromolting for several instars, like getting smaller and smaller each time. And then when food's around, they can molt progressively forward again. They can go back and forth like this for years. Research has shown. So it's kind of crazy. You have like insects that basically have found the eternal grail for youth. I think that's pretty cool.
I have a new insect superpower.
And then another thing is that some people really don't, I think, understand that some of these stored products have just such a wide host range that they basically eat everything. if you think of, for example, the Indian mill moth, it has over 100 documented commodities that it will eat, ranging from seeds to animal products to books to medicine to, you know, I mean, you can almost name anything that has some sort of organic component and it's going to have been documented feeding on it, which is kind of cool.
Chocolate, candy bars in vending machines.
Yeah, chocolate's on there. Dried fruit.
Powdered donuts in vending machines.
There's a lot of cool things about stored product entomology, but it's just kind of fascinating once you dig down little bit deeper under the surface, there's some really cool kind of biology and adaptations that they have for exploiting unpredictable food resources and making their way, no matter what your packaging is, to what they want to eat.
So I know that you deal with a lot of different stakeholders. I know that you talk to a lot of different folks. I think it would be kind of interesting if we could just do a little bit of a rundown about, I mean, you just were talking about some extraordinary things, but maybe what are the most common things that maybe a homeowner would encounter, or what would be common for somebody to encounter even in a grocery store, like a professional working in a grocery store type setting? What would be the most common pest?
Yeah, so first I'll deal with the homeowner. Probably the homeowner, things that they'll most come into contact with are either Indian mill moth, carpet beetle, or clothes moth. That's kind of been my experience from talking with folks. And so, you know, if you see moths flying around your house, that should be kind of a warning sign. Or if you start to see little holes in your clothing, or you see little beetles embedded in on the edges of your carpet around the baseboard, that should be a cue that there's something off. Probably someone in a supermarket setting may not find as many clothes moths or carpet beetles. You're definitely going to find Indian mill moth. You're going to find red flower beetle. A lot of the kinds of pests that attack what we call secondary pests, so those that attack finished products or products where you don't have an intact kernel. Another big source for kind of these stored product pests is like birdseed. Like if you buy that, it's often in bulk. And you know, if you just like take it in your house or set it somewhere, you know, you're just like opening up your whole pantry for all sorts of attack by various insects. So, you know, those are probably some of the prime ones.
Jody, have you shared with Rob before your experiences at we'll have an unnamed mega store here in the Omaha area that you often go hunting for these kinds of pests at?
Yes, and I was there last week, and I was actually standing by the shelves looking for Indian mill moths, because that's what I do, and two staff members were walking around looking. They're like, I can't find it. Where's the trap? And I already looked. There was no trap there, but they were wandering around looking for it. I found it's like that, you know, that board in the middle of the shelves that have all those holes in there. It's like all webbing. It's all
gross.
Yeah. Gross.
And that's really a problem. I actually just published an article on this, of the importance of sanitation at various kinds of food facilities. Think about loading products and offloading products. Sometimes there's holes in packages. You get some sort of spillage of flour or other various things. And then it just kind of sits in a corner. And those are like great refugia for insects to, one, colonize, but then they can, you know, infest other products that are nearby. You know, once they've kind of repeated that, kind of go on to infest your main product. And I've gone to facilities like unnamed mills and elevators where where like you go and there's just all this spillage, like all this seed, like all over the ground everywhere, and you just like uncover it just the very top, and you just see all these little things running around in there. And that's like right adjacent to where they're keeping their main commodity. And it's like, you need to like deal with this, or it's going to be a problem for you in selling your product and not having it be downgraded.
You need a badge for those kinds of instances that you can live out and be like, hey, bug police.
Yeah, because we need that, because we tell people that, but I think we're both like smiling ear to ear, because you're telling us exactly what we tell to homeowners and our clients, but they're like, it's nowhere close to our bird food. Nowhere close. I'm like, it's got wings, right? No. I've never seen them in the bird food.
That's the other thing, you know, is that we've been talking a lot about associated with retailers and so forth, but you can find some of these insects just far away from any, you know, artificial environment or stored product facility. So like if I were to just go out right now on the Kansas Prairie out here in Kansas and just put up some pheromone traps, you know, miles and miles away from anything else, I'm going to be catching lesser grain borer. I might catch some rusty grain beetle, you know, so you can catch these insects far away from actual facilities. They have natural refugia in the environment. And so one of the challenges is, you know, preventing them from getting from that sort of natural refugia and then like invading your home or invading, you know, your warehouse or whatever you're responsible for. So that's another aspect of that.
So when we talk about these pests, what are the issues that we're discussing here? I think that sometimes when I talk to people about this, they have a hard time understanding what these little bugs could do to their food. So what do people need to be worried about? Are they just losing their food? Is it a spoilage issue? Are they going to catch some sort of diphtheria from the fecal material of the insect?
Can I still eat it?
Right.
Like, they're always like, well, is it going to kill me?
So I think there's a mix of issues. So I can go through each. So basically, one concern is you're losing actual food that people could eat. You know, they're actually consuming grain. And so if you look at some of these species, like you can bind them to a certain amount of food for a given amount of time, like corn, for example. And you know, corn has very big seed kernels relative to other things. Like by the time, you know, like after, let's say, a month or two, all those kernels will be skeletonized, basically. So you'll just see the outline of where the seed used to be. And that really is not what you want. You don't want to be storing your product and then end up with a flour that's a mix of frass and ground up little bits. So there's the actual weight loss and economic loss that's a result of it. Also, insects can create wonderful micro habitats in these grain storage environments to foster like microbes and fungi and all sorts of things. And so in the developing world, especially aflatoxin is a huge issue, which is a sort of toxin that's produced by fungi. And insects, when they're infesting the grain, can create like perfect humidity conditions and like warm up the grain so that it's even more conducive to that kind of spoilage for microbes than it would otherwise be. So there's that bit of it. And then some of the research that I'm doing in my lab, we're looking to see whether either passively or actively, whether these stored product insects can vector some of these like aflatoxin and some of these microbes to and from different, you know, sort of grain environments. And so that's kind of an active area of research right now. I don't want to say anything specific about whether that's true or not, but I will say that there is definitely an interaction between the insect community and other sorts of pests like microbes and fungi and that sort of thing. So,
very interesting. I'm very fascinated by this. I always have been. I grew up in an agricultural community. We had a grain bin on my parents' property that wasn't ours. And I always thought it was amazing to come and see people try and treat it, I guess, and try and keep it clean and keep the bugs out, they would always say. Can you give us just like a brief history of that sort of situation? What have we done to try and prevent this in the past? And maybe where are we headed in the future? Are things getting easier for people who store grain or for people who have these products, but no. Or are they getting harder?
So historically, at least for the past, let's say until the very recent time, the most common tactic to control most of these stored product insects was to use methyl bromide, which is a fumigant that is applied as a gas. And so that's unfortunately been sort of phased out of use because it's been classified as an ozone depleting compound by the Montreal Protocol. And so that's kind of was the crutch for a long time for most of the industry, was to use that whenever there was an insect problem, and it was cheap and it was easy to use. It's highly toxic. It has a high mammalian toxicity and is very dangerous, but it was really easy to use. But now that that's been phased out, there's kind of a search for alternative methods to control a lot of these pests. And at the same time, the main remaining fumigant, which is phosphine, there's increasing problems with resistance worldwide to that by a variety of taxa. And so you have these challenges in preserving the efficacy of our one remaining like widespread fumigant. Then on the consumer side of things, you also have people demanding kind of low insecticide inputs or organic inputs throughout the supply chain, like even after harvest. And so there's kind of this dual pressure right now to develop a kind of suite of, you know, diversified IPM tactics to help food facility managers kind of address the threat posed by insects. And so that's kind of where things are at and kind of going. And then if we think in terms of longer term, you know, and meeting the protein requirements for society more generally, you know, we could get into a conversation of, well, could we use insects as food themselves? And is that going to be sort of the future of, you know, sort of morphing with stored product entomology? I mean, there's still the problem with economic losses, but could we, you know, utilize some of these insects as a potential alternative food source? So that may be where things are going in the more distant sort of future.
Fumigators are going to become bug farmers, is what it sounds like.
Who knows? We'll see what happens. But I think there's still a big cultural barrier right now to really having widespread insects as food. But I think the more that people interact with insects and the more people see like cricket meal bread or, you know, these various sorts of products that are coming out, I think the more comfortable people will become with it.
I think it's important to note, too, that this you know, protection of food is a worldwide problem, right? Like,
Exactly.
Do you have the stats on how much damage is worldwide?
Yeah, very good point. So every year, you know, it's estimated we lose 10 to 30% of our products after harvest just from these insects. And so that translates to a value of about $100 billion worldwide. In the U.S., it amounts to about $9 billion annually. And so, you know, it's a huge problem. And if you think about as our population continues to increase on the planet, you know, how are we going to feed all these people? And especially when you consider that you can get even higher losses than what I've mentioned in developing countries where there's not the access to effective pest management tactics, or you have a lot of small stakeholders that aren't necessarily have the same resources. You can get up to 70-75% losses there. So that's you buy a hamburger, right? And three quarters of it is already gone before you've been able to start eating it. You know what I mean? So this disproportionately affects the poorest in the world right now. And so there could be a lot done to target some efforts to increasing efficacy of management approaches for specifically poor, small stakeholders in the developing world. And I have a student right now, Hannah Qualforce, who's working on improving management in the developing world through a variety of novel tactics. So she's been working on that project and kind of taking that kind of global food security sort of approach to that.
That sounds really impressive. I'm always amazed to hear what we're doing on a global scale. I know that Jody and I, we don't get to quite do anything like that. We just talk to angry people that find bugs in their pantry.
Yeah, they're mad that their BizQuick needs to be thrown out now.
Their five-pound bag of rice.
And that's the thing is most people don't even think about store products as being an issue until they go home and they open their container and it's just filled with like silk from Indian mill moth or, you know, whatever the problem may be. And then they're like, oh my God, what is this? You know, and then they get really angry and it's like, well, it's a perfect source of food for not just you, but for lots of other things too. So that's what, kind of what I'm trying to help prevent and, you know, minimize those economic losses.
So one thing that we talk to a lot of people about in our day-to-day work with this kind of stuff is that I feel like I've had many, many more people than it should be have asked, like, well, okay, what do I spray onto my noodles or onto my flour in order to combat this issue? And I say, well, you know, then you can't eat it either. That would be bad. So we talked to them a lot about pantry moth or pantry beetle pheromone traps. Do you have any experience with those? Can you teach our listeners just a little bit about what's going on with those kinds of traps and their efficacy?
Sure. So at this point, you know, there's no real attract and kill technology. So you can't really use these traps to manage your populations. If you have a really severe infestation, what you can do is use them to monitor if you have a problem. So if you have the trap out and you start getting captures, you can be like, okay, there's a problem somewhere in my house, you know, and then you can maybe do something about it. Really the better thing to do, and it depends on what your pest is, but for example, if you have Indian mill moth, you can use pheromones for mating disruption. So there are companies that make high dose sort of lures for mating disruption, and that helps break the life cycle so that males can't locate females and kind of breaks that. But if you're just talking about the regular trap where you have sort of a either card or something with a little septa with a little lure, that's not going to help your problem. What you typically need to do is take whatever you think is infested, maybe even all the stuff in your pantry. And if you want to keep it, I would freeze it for over a week. And if most of it, I would just throw out and just, you know, start anew. And the real, I think, key to having kind of good sanitation is in the kitchen is having airtight, kind of hard plastic or glass containers where you're confining whatever products you have and separating them. That way, when you bring new stuff in from the store, like anything you bring in could potentially be infested, you know, so you need to immediately put it into its own, you know, container, seal it. And then the rest of your stuff is also protected because it's already in its own sealed container. So that's what I would mostly recommend for homeowners.
Yeah,
Preach, brother. Yeah, that's great advice. It's its own quarantine, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think one of the things I've always wanted to know is, I think we talked about this a little bit, but like the Capra beetle and that, how that's on a quarantine list.
Sure. So I actually have several research projects looking at developing better monitoring and management approaches for the Capra beetle. The Capra beetle has been one of those species that's been ranked consistently in the top 100 worst invasive species of all time. And one of the primary reasons for that is a severe infestation was found in the U.S. in like the early 1950s, about 1953, about 151 sites in three different southwestern states, so New Mexico, California, Arizona. And at the time, the government spent in 1950 dollars over $11 million to get rid of that infestation. And that translates in today's money to $104 million. So you think of spending $104 million on an invasive insect, that's an incredible amount, even for some of these, you know, hugely impactful species such as brown marmorated stink bug or spotted wing Drosophila, like in these $10 million projects, like, but still nowhere near that $100 million that was spent. So it's been an increasing problem recently because there have been more detections of it at ports of entry by APHIS. And so I have a project where we're collaborating with APHIS colleagues in Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts. They have a quarantine facility out there where they rear the Capra beetle. And so we go out there probably once a year, do some collaborative research with them on that. And then we also do some complementary studies on a related species called the warehouse beetle, which is in the same genus as Capra beetle, but is established in the U.S. And so we've kind of pulled our resources to kind of look at behavior, chemical ecology, and if we can develop more efficient monitoring devices and management strategies so that our goal would be to exclude it from the U.S., but assuming we can't exclude it, be prepared with, management tactics that stakeholders can use if it does become established. So.
Does it feed on the same things that the warehouse beetle does?
It even looks very similar to the warehouse beetle. Like if you were to look at a side-by-side picture, it would probably be hard without a microscope to tell them apart.
Thought I had one once.
Yeah, like how would we know?
There's a DNA test that you can do, like a quick certifier thing at the APHIS facility that I work with. They do that as a service. So when they get a potentially infested material, they send off a sample to the quarantine facility and then they do their quick DNA screen, look to see if it's actually Capra beetle. And that's the way that they typically establish whether it is or not in the past.
Anything that we should be prioritizing that as people who get a lot of these samples? Should we be keeping any of our dermestid samples and sending them off just in case or?
Yeah, like what type of products and what area of, like if someone brought something back from somewhere, is it a certain part of the world?
So, places anywhere where products are coming in from outside, the country is going to be kind of a target area. So the airports, I don't know if you have an international airport in Omaha or wherever, there are things like that where you're getting, packages. Like a lot, sometimes these can come often from India or, some grain has been shipped and they're kind of just in with that packaging. And so I'd keep an eye out one for if there's kind of a unusual, like large increase in the number of warehouse beetle samples you're getting in an area. In that case, I would be like, okay, well, warehouse beetle usually isn't this damaging and this widespread. Usually Capra beetle will be the superior competitor. So if you see something like that, then I would be like, well, maybe I should take a closer look at this. And you can feel free to contact me. I can put you in touch with the APHIS people and, coordinate that or whatever. So I would just keep out an eye out for things that look unusual or a high spike in the numbers that you're seeing or whatever. That's what I would think.
And if we do, we know a guy who knows a guy is what I'm hearing.
Right. And then one of the other things, because when we study, stored product pests, there's always like the red flower beetle, and then there's the confused flower beetle. And then there's like sawtooth grain beetle, but then there's the merchant grain beetle. They're like doppelgangers, but they're different. Why is that? Do we know that? And like one flies and one doesn't,
Yeah.
And so it's always important for them to consult an entomologist of which one is it, because we want to know if it flies or not, because then that's who to blame, right?
Yeah.
Or something like that. It has to do with money. But it's always so interesting to me that, there's the drugstore beetle or it could be the cigarette beetle. Like there's always the twin.
I guess thinking evolutionarily in the past, obviously these species probably evolved in slightly different habitats where maybe flying was more important for dispersal, whereas You know, maybe in the past for one of the species, there were a lot of, you know, individuals in a given area. So you can just like walk around mostly and, you know, do what you need to do. So as a like long-term answer to that question, that might be the reason. Pretty much the short answer is we don't know.
I've even asked
established people, like people that are about to retire here in my center who have worked their whole lives in stored products, and they can't give me a good answer about that either. So. I don't know that we know at this point, but that should be a call out to like evolutionary biologists. Like if you're listening to this and you want to tackle this problem, that it's not being done right now. So. Yeah.
Okay. Well, those are the questions that I've always had. Those are the ones burning in my heart.
I'm just kind of curious to hear more about, it sounds like you're doing a lot of amazing research projects and you've got some cool students doing some really neat stuff. And I hope to hear more about that at some meetings in the future, but if you could just speak broadly about, like, how does your research and how does the USDA help to protect our food and the world's food and what those projects are leading towards?
I can tell you that, you know, every day I'm so excited to come to work because I feel like I'm doing research that is of benefit to society. I feel like, you know, for example, some of the projects we have right now, one of them is looking at long-lasting insecticide netting. So this has historically been used for as bed nets to control the spread of malaria in tropical countries. But we're looking at it to be as one of those exclusion mechanisms to prevent insects from immigrating into a food facility from the landscape, from those natural refugia we talked about earlier. And so, you know, we're looking at that, and that's shown to be highly effective and is a very promising tactic. Now, even brief amounts of contact make it so that they can't disperse to a novel food resource, even if it's just, you know, 100 centimeters away. So that's very encouraging. So we're doing a lot of research basically that has very valuable applications to stakeholders and help sort of, as we mentioned, diversify the IPM tactics available for stored product folks, for my research in particular, but more generally, you know, there are labs looking at other invasive species like brown marmorated stink bug, helping to develop efficient monitoring and management strategies. You know, we're doing a lot of research, I think, that really kind of, you know, some of it might have sort of kind of a basic angle, but kind of with an applied twist. So we need to know some of this basic information about an insect, like how it responds to pheromones and how it moves in the environment in order to develop realistic approaches to managing their populations. And so I think the USDA is perfect for, you know, doing a lot of this applied research that kind of balances that basic and applied approach to deliver like actual tools and strategies that end users can help with their own management sort of situation. So that explains it.
Well, cool. Thanks. And I really like your enthusiasm for your work and your research.
I think he's entomologist, a good role model.
Yeah. Role model, I like everything.
So. I think hearing somebody
I appreciate that.
I think hearing somebody talk about that they pursued the kind of career that they did because they want to help people. I think that there's a lot of, I guess, young students that are kind of in that mindset. I feel like that's a trait of some of the younger people that I've met at meetings. Right. Is that they are invested in that kind of work. So hearing that there's occupations out there in that arena is probably very encouraging for them.
Exactly. And, you know, like, I feel like, you know, I'm just one person. Like, I can't change the whole world, but I can do my part. And I can, you know, if as my job, I am working every day to improve society, I feel like I'm doing what I can, you know, to push things in the right direction.
That's a beautiful thing.
It is. And now I feel bad asking this question, but if you weren't an entomologist, what would you be? But I don't want you to be anything but you and be an entomologist.
Yeah, we've got the fun questions.
Yeah, so the fun questions are at the end.
So your first fun question that you wrote down, Jody, is if you were not an entomologist, what would you do? What would you be doing?
Yeah, that's so hard for me.
So do you want to just say
because I live and breathe entomology.
Yeah. Okay, pass.
But if I did have to say something, you know, and I think, and just thinking about what could I do every day for the rest of my life, it would probably be a photographer. Like, I really love taking photos, and I use, like, you know, really nice photos to help tell my scientific stories, you know? So if all I was left with was my photos, I might still be okay.
And I think that maybe we'll feature some of those in the blog post that we have for this particular episode, with your permission, of course.
Of course, yeah.
And then this is Jody's most favorite question to ask people. You're going to have to do it.
If you could have any insect appendage or special characteristic, what would it be?
So I know you're going to think this is very boring of me, but I would definitely have wings, but not podunk bee or fly wings. Like I would want kind of monarch wings, you know, so I can glide around. And if I wanted to get caught in like a thermal updraft or something and go into the atmosphere, I could do that, you know, like that, those are the kind of wings I would want. It's funny. I had a best friend and we would always ask people, you know, what, if you had a superpower, would it be flight or invisibility? And usually, like, all the people that picked invisibility would pick it for, like, criminal reasons. Like, they would want to spy on people, or they would want to, like, you know, like, learn information they shouldn't have access to, or, you know, like, just, like, things like that. And I've always loved the idea of being able to fly. And so I think it would be wings for me.
That's an awesome choice.
That's awesome. I do not think that's boring at all.
Not at all.
No.
That's a beautiful reason.
The explanation is awesome.
I think the last time you asked this question, you asked if you could be an insect appendage, and you confused one of our guests very much.
That's why I don't know why you let me ask the question.
Because I believe in you. I believe in you very much. What was yours? What would you pick, Jody?
I think I said furcula.
You go with a furcula so you can hop around?
But if I could have any superpower, it would be to teleport, because I don't like traveling. Like, I just don't like the airport waiting. I don't like the waiting and the customs.
Your commute would be cut down quite a bit.
Yeah, 1 year I missed 5 flights. Like, I don't know. I have like a traveling problem.
But you know, if there was teleportation technology, it'd be you have to go and wait in line for your turn to teleport or whatever. So you'd still have to go to the teleportation center or whatever.
And we couldn't get a fly in your teleporting path. Otherwise, you'd come out with boring podunk fly wings and all kinds of. It would be bad. That would be bad.
There you go.
I think this has been.
Wait, what's yours?
Oh, what's my superpower or what's my insect appendage?
Both.
Oh, insect appendage? I really do like the idea of Cersei, like earwig Cersei. Oh. I think that'd be fun. His wing explanation is it's kind of pushing me that direction, though. And antenna, I think, are neat, but I'm going to go with my heart and go with Cersei, the big, grippy Cersei that earwigs have. Maybe because I was stabbed by them once. Oh. It's in my blood. If I had a superpower, I think we've talked about this, I would be a shapeshifter. I would want to be able to change shape. I think that'd be fun. Or stretchy, like Mr. Fantastic. I think that'd be cool.
See, we actually talk about this quite a bit.
We go on a lot of road trips. We're in extinction.
It's a very important conversation to have.
We get bored in the car. We can't listen to ourselves on a podcast all the time.
It's true.
Well, Rob, I just wanted to say thank you. I think this has been a really cool interview. I think you've provided a lot of amazing information. Is there anything that we can link to in our show notes that maybe people could look at some of the work that you're doing, or if you have a Twitter page or anything like that?
My Twitter handle is Morrison Lab USDA. So if you want to follow me, that'd be great. I also have a WordPress sort of lab website, just William Robert Morrison III.wordpress.com. And then also I have my official government, webpage. So you can just look up, you know, William Morrison USDA ARS.
Cool.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity.
Yeah, this is a great show. Looking forward to talking to you more at ESA meetings in the future. If you want to find our show on the internet, we are at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can find the show on almost any podcatcher out there, including Stitcher, Apple Podcasts. You can find us on Podcast Addict, just about anywhere that you can find audio entertainment. We are there. If you want to support the show, we don't take donations or anything, but we do take ideas for future episodes. If you want to tweet those at us or email them to us, or if you want to support us by leaving a review, we would be deeply appreciative of that as well. I am at @JLarson_UNL.
And I'm at @JodyBugsMeUNL. Obviously, I haven't been bugging people enough.
You forgot almost your own Twitter handle. And the show is arthropod_show on Twitter, if I remember correctly.
Maybe.
Just type in arthropod a bunch, and eventually it'll pop up, I'm sure, on Twitter. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. We're going to be back here in a couple of weeks to learn more about lots of different entomological topics, and we will catch you then and there.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
And we're done.